The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated February 26, 2024. As usual, the front cover is outlined in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large capital block lettering in gray, superimposed upon a black background. This entire page encompasses a jaggedy-looking geographical map of Ukraine. Blue on top, gold on the bottom, the country's colors. There are dots connected by lines superimposing this map, and they are the satellite hits, the satellite signals. The first war, or the first AI war, is the title on the cover that was read in last week's edition. So I'll begin this day with the brief. Not Quite a Little Town by Andrew R. Chow. The incessant din of a Bitcoin mine, and Bitcoin is one word, in overlooked rural America. And again, that's by Andrew R. Chow. It's just a one-page article. Every night, the nurse anesthetist Cheryl Shadden lies awake in her home in Granbury, Texas, listening to a nonstop war. It is like sitting on the runway of an airport where jets are taking off one after another, she says. You cannot speak to somebody 5 feet away and have them hear you at all. The noise comes from a nearby Bitcoin mining operation, which set up shop at a power plant in Granbury last year. Since then, residents in the surrounding area have complained to public officials about an incessant din that they say keeps them awake, gives them migraines, and apparently has scared off wildlife. My citizens are suffering, says Hood County Constable John Shirley. Rural America has not shared much in the wealth of the tech boom, or in areas without broadband, even much of the tech. But the impacts of Bitcoin mining, an energy-intensive process that powers and protects cryptocurrency, are distinctly negative for many residents. Noise, carbon pollution, and higher utility bills. Some 34 large-scale Bitcoin mines operate across the U.S., according to the New York Times, and despite high-profile crypto collapses in 2022, mining companies last year expanded operations to cash in on a rebound. One study said global energy consumption for mining doubled. Bitcoin is so energy intensive because it relies on a process known as proof of work. Rather than being overseen by a single authority, like a central bank, Bitcoin disperses the responsibility of the network's integrity to voluntary miners across the globe, who prevent tampering through a complex cryptographic process that consumes a vast amount of energy. Texas has become a global industry leader because miners can access cheap energy and land there and benefit from friendly tax laws and regulation. Bitcoin miners consume about 2,100 megawatts of the state's power supplies, an amount that can power hundreds of thousands of homes. Companies like Riot Platforms and Marathon Digital Holdings have recently expanded in the state. Other states have pushed back. In 2022, New York imposed a moratorium on Bitcoin mining over environmental concerns. Bitcoin mining plants, like data centers, run massive cooling fans to keep their computers from overheating. The rumble from the Granbury plant reached Shannon Wolf in her home 8 miles away. She thought it was a nearby train. "It has woken me from a dead sleep before," she says. Other residents of the town, which stands on the Brazos River, an hour southwest of Fort Worth, took their complaints to social media. "This sound has been driving me to the point of insanity. I have continuous migraines. I can barely get out of my head. Vomiting, nosebleeds, painful knots on my scalp," wrote one commenter. "All the birds have left. Only buzzards," wrote another. Local officials brought their concerns to the site's operator, U.S. Bitcoin Corporation. Over the summer, the company constructed a 24-foot sound barrier wall on one end of the property, at the cost of $1 million to $2 million. But while the wall reduced sound in some areas, it amplified it in others. "To be honest, the complaints have gotten louder for us since the mitigation efforts," Constable Shirley says. Texas state law stipulates a noise is considered unreasonable if it exceeds 85 decibels. For comparison, vacuum cleaners often run at around 75 decibels, though a cardiologist told Time in 2018 that chronic exposure to anything over 60 decibels had the potential to do harm to the cardiovascular system. Shannon took her own readings at her house near the Bitcoin mining facility that reached 103 decibels. But the maximum penalty for breaking that Texas law is a $500 fine, Shirley says, adding, "The state law is inadequate." He says he's been talking to the county attorney's office about options for recourse. "If we have a repeated violation problem, he will be looking into potential injunctive relief," he says. The community's ire boiled over at a packed town hall January 29. One of the attendees said she'd been forced to put her chihuahua on seizure medication. Others said their windows rattled from the vibrations and the noise made their homes unsellable. "How does Hood County benefit from having such a ridiculous thing?" asked one woman. After the town hall, the site's owner, Marathon Digital Holdings, announced it planned to take over full day-to-day operations of the Granbury mine. "Our team will now have more influence over the site and can hopefully have a more positive impact for the community," a spokesman said in an email to Time. U.S. Bitcoin Corp. does not respond to a request for comment. Eric Cojola, a senior climate research specialist for Greenpeace USA, says he's monitored complaints from residents near new Bitcoin mining centers in Iowa, Indiana, Nebraska, and upstate New York. "Bitcoin mining is essentially a lifeline for fossil fuels," he says. "It is ultimately creating a new industrial-scale demand for energy at a time where we need to be reducing our energy use." Next, the brief health. Five Ways to Deal with Climate Despair by Angela Haupt. Forget climate anxiety. Many people are in flat-out climate distress. About two-thirds of Americans, 65%, report being worried about global warming. according to a January report from the Yale Program for Climate Communication. 1 in 10 say they've recently felt depressed over their concerns for the planet, and a similar percentage describe feeling on edge, or like they're unable to stop worrying about global warming. No wonder more people are seeking care from climate-aware therapists. Some go to therapy to figure out whether they should have kids in the age of rapid climate change. Others are dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder from natural disasters or are burned out from advocacy work. But if the threat is existential, is there value in sorting out how you feel about it? The very first step is full validation, says Leslie Davenport, a climate psychology educator and author. Understand that it is not irrational to be full of worry, rage, fear, or guilt when the planet's on fire. Instead of ignoring them, take the energy of all those emotions and redirect them into constructive action, says Dr. Lisa Van Susteren, a psychiatrist in Washington, D.C., who co-founded the Climate Psychiatry Alliance. You could advocate for change and make changes yourself, reducing your carbon footprint by walking or biking instead of driving, for example. Here, climate-aware therapists share their most effective coping strategies for going from overwhelmed to empowered. First, find your people. Climate change tends to get the religion and politics treatment. People avoid talking about it, says Carol Bartles, a therapist in Long Beach, California. But we need to talk about it, she adds. We need to know other people are feeling the same. Join a climate cafe discussion spaces, both online and in person, where people can talk freely about their fears and other feelings related to climate change. Or try the Good Grief Network, a peer support group that follows a 10-step approach to help people process any type of grieving, including for the planet. 2, share your views. This is no time for humility. Make sure everyone around you knows what you are doing to combat climate change, Van Susteren says. What motivates people is not our independence. We follow the crowd. Someone might not make green choices in the interest of future generations, but will do it if everyone else is. So post about your advocacy work or the trees you planted on Facebook and tell whoever you're standing next to at parties. If you're surrounded by people who don't appear to prioritize the environment as much as you do, lead by example rather than trying to change their minds, Bartles advises. Getting angry with people does zero good, she says. 3, make it a family affair. Some research suggests climate change is especially affecting young people's mental health. If your kids are coming to you with concerns, listen to and validate them, Van Susteren says. Then get imaginative about how your whole family can take action together. If your kids are young, you're not going to talk about climate tipping points, but you can say, let's plant a garden, let's clean up a park, let's show Mother Earth that we care about her. Older kids might like to start or join climate clubs. If they express interest in going to a protest, ask if they would like you to tag along, or if you can help get them there. You can also have family meetings and say, we have taken your feelings seriously, and we have decided as a family that these are some of the things we can do, Van Susteren suggests. 4, get artsy. Making art can help people regulate and work through their emotions, says Ariella Cook Shonkoff, a psychotherapist in Berkeley, California, who specializes in art therapy and ecotherapy. You are doing patterned, repetitive movements and getting into a flow state, she says. It is calming. Try it in the natural world by sketching in front of the ocean or on a bench in the woods, for example. 5, and finally, savor time outside. Spending time outside in green spaces benefits well-being. Though Davenport acknowledges it can be complex. You go to your favorite lake, but it's closed because there's toxic algae growth caused by warm water. A hike in the woods in the dead of winter is lovely, but the unseasonable warmth unnerves you. Love and grief are two sides of the same coin, she says. It is worth pushing through, she says, because doing so can renew your sense of why it is important to fight for this. The View, subcaptioned The World, The War Nobody Wants, by William Waldorf. Waldorf is a professor of politics and international affairs at Wake Forest University, and Waldorf's last name is spelled W-A-L-L-D-O-R-F. The U.S. is creeping toward war in the Middle East. A drone attack on a U.S. base in Jordan, January 29, killed 3 American troops and injured 34 others. A militia supported by Iran claimed responsibility. In retaliation, President Joe Biden ordered 85 strikes in Iraq and Syria and promised more to come. A dangerous escalation that could spiral out of control. Are Americans ready for war? Not at all. Pro-Israel sentiments aside, the U.S. public and its leaders are deeply divided today about Middle East policy. War will not only lead to recession and drain U.S. resources to the benefit of China, but rifts at home could also do harm to U.S. foreign policy for years to come. It is time, then, for Biden to de-escalate tension and push Israel toward peace. Each major U.S. war since 1900 was buoyed at its outset by a big story that research shows galvanized national consensus and buy-in to the costs of war. A story about the existential danger of Soviet expansion and stopping communism brought robust initial support for wars in Korea and Vietnam. In the 2000s and 2010s, the big story was about September 11 and defeating terrorism. The War on Terror narrative helped generate strong initial public support for U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, 88% in 2001, and Iraq, 70% in 2003. So where is the U.S. national story today? Well, there is none. The anti-terrorism narrative disappeared with the decline of Al-Qaeda and ISIS in the late 2010s. By 2019, 59% said Afghanistan was not worth fighting, and only 27% said interventions in other countries made the U.S. safer. In short, with terrorism down, U.S. energy independence up, and Iran more a nuisance than an existential threat, the U.S. is left today with no big unifying story for deep Middle East engagement, especially war. The absence of a big story is showing up today in debates about the Middle East. Polls show 84% of Americans worry about getting pulled into war. Some 65% want a ceasefire in Israel's war in Gaza, not U.S. military action. Biden's efforts to rally the nation with eloquent statements have not worked either. As other presidents can attest, that happens with no big story. Only 33% approve of Biden's handling of today's crisis. Opposition to Biden's approach on Gaza will only expand with a wider war. Young voters strongly oppose his unwavering support for Israel's disproportionate use of force in Gaza, which has killed at least 26,000 Palestinians, most of them women and children. Progressive Democrats are balking too. A new U.S. war today will create deep revulsion from these quarters. Revulsion will also come from Republicans. The powerful nationalist wing of the GOP is uncomfortable with war today. Donald Trump complained recently about too much bombing in the Middle East, and some MAGA leaders want to slow or stop military action. All this should give U.S. decision makers pause. Unpopular wars can create a lot of public resistance to wars that are actually in the national interest. Direct U.S. involvement in a Middle East war today would be terrible, at a time when Washington needs to remain nimble and engaged to manage major challenges in Asia and Europe. Biden needs to bring the temperature down. He should rule out any strikes inside Iran, which denied involvement in the January 29 attack. He should also reconsider further airstrikes against the Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen and return to the defensive posture of intercepting incoming attacks on international shipping in the Red Sea. This strategy was working effectively, no deaths or major damage, before the U.S. began strikes in Yemen, and can work going forward. In general, striking Iranian proxies does little damage to their capabilities, but does a lot to enhance their legitimacy. Stepping back helps get the U.S. off the escalation ladder to war. The Biden administration can concurrently reduce accessible targets for Iran-backed groups. That means pressing and perhaps mandating U.S.-flagged vessels to avoid the Red Sea, and redeploying troops in Jordan, Syria, and Iraq to more secure regional bases farther afield from the ongoing Israel-Hamas war. The U.S. regularly moves highly exposed troops for force protection. Most crucially, Washington needs to push Israel to a ceasefire in Gaza. Its war is quickly becoming a regional war at odds with U.S. interests. A ceasefire will cool regional tensions, stop further escalation, keep the U.S. home front from exploding, and bring policy in line with true U.S. national security interests, most of which now lie outside the Middle East. A just Middle East policy before it's too late. Written by William Waldorf, professor at Wake Forest University. There's one photo on this article that's basically one page long, but the photo takes up maybe the top quarter in a corner of the page. I'll read the caption first. Biden at the arrival of U.S. soldiers remains at Dover Air Force Base, February 2. The sky is a milky whitish blue. President Biden is standing on the tarmac, his right hand over his heart. He's dressed in black shoes, black trousers, black overcoat, black gloves, white shirt, dark tie. He looks somber. In the far background are defoliated trees, a few more runways, layered with grass in between. It looks like a small layer cake. And then in the front, six uniformed troops carrying a coffin draped in a U.S. flag. And here's another one-page article. This is the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. Keep a wary eye on North Korea. Over the decades, North Korea's leaders have periodically made bombastic threats of military force against South Korea and its foreign backers, particularly the U.S. and Japan. And for the most part, while carefully monitoring North Korean military moves on the ground, by sea and in the air, leaders in Seoul, Washington, and Tokyo could dismiss these incendiary-sounding warnings as a substitute for action rather than a sign that aggression is imminent. There are reasons why that might be changing and why we should now pay closer attention to what Kim Jong-un and his generals are up to. There are growing worries North Korea could carry out a surprise attack or launch some other provocation against South Korea over the course of this year, even if it falls short of war. The risk looks particularly high in the run-up to South Korea's next legislative elections, now set for April. First, it is worth noting North Korea's Kim has publicly stepped away from previous claims that Pyongyang's ultimate goal is a peaceful reunification of the two Koreas on North Korea's terms. A fantasy North Korean officials have promoted for decades. To be sure that his point was not too subtle, he recently ordered the destruction of a large monument to reunification in Pyongyang and tagged South Korea as his country's primary foe and invariable principal enemy. This comes at a time when North Korea is also partnering more closely with Moscow in the supply of weapons and ammunition for Korea's war on Ukraine, particularly in exchange for Russian technology that could boost North Korea's long-range firepower, satellite coverage, and cyber capabilities, including against American targets. The long-time ideological affinity Moscow and Pyongyang share in hopes of building a world order no longer dominated by U.S. power has increasingly shifted into commercial relations with battlefield importance, boosting Pyongyang's self-confidence and maybe its risk tolerance. Second, I am hearing more overt warnings from senior Chinese officials, unhappy with closer North Korean-Russian relations, of a potentially explosive threat that North Korea poses for South Korea. For his part, South Korea's president, Yoon Suk-yeol, is offering no conciliation in response. In fact, he's pledged his country would hit back multiple times as hard against any North Korean assault. North Korea has become more aggressive in the past month. In the first week of January, its forces fired artillery shells into a buffer zone near the maritime border that separates North and South Korea. Seoul fired back, though no casualties were reported. January 14, North Korea test-fired a solid-fuel intermediate-range ballistic missile. January 19, it claimed to have tested a nuclear-capable underwater attack drone, though South Korean officials called this claim exaggerated. January 24 and 28, North Korea test-fired submarine-launched strategic cruise missiles. January 30, it test-fired a land-based strategic cruise missile. Even by Pyongyang's standards, that is a lot of noise in a single month. The basic facts that have prevented war for the past 70 years have not changed enough for anyone to expect an open cross-border conflict. Beijing still has crucial influence within Pyongyang's political and military leadership, and China's Xi Jinping has taken notice of North Korea's new tone. There is also still an understanding on both sides of the DMZ that given the weapons in both countries' arsenals, an all-out war would quickly kill tens of millions of people, and North Korea's government would cease to exist. But that is not enough to prevent provocative border incursions, drone infiltrations of opposing airspace, cyber attacks, and other actions that raise the risk of accidental confrontation that both sides might find hard to contain. The Biden administration is now focused on turmoil in Gaza, on Ukraine's battlefield, and at the U.S. southern border. that should not take anyone's focus off North Korea's newly belligerent behavior. The View Inbox CO2 Leadership Brief by Justin Warland, Senior Correspondent. Ever since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, economic output has grown in lockstep with carbon emissions. The relationship is simple. The more humans produce and consume, the more energy is required. And more energy equals more emissions. That history has led to a persistent belief that dealing with climate change means accepting lower growth. Now, reality is challenging that assumption. New analyses point out that carbon emissions are diverging from economic growth in many countries. The fact that emissions can be durably decoupled from economic growth is real-world proof that the green transition underway can endure without crushing the economy. In January, the Rhodium Group, an independent research firm, found U.S. carbon emissions dropped slightly even as the economy grew, in large part because of the continued move away from coal power. The International Energy Agency showed how this same trend is playing out across developed countries. GDP has grown while emissions drop in the U.S., Europe, Japan, Korea, Australia, and New Zealand. In countries like India and China, the speed at which emissions are increasing has slowed, even as the economy grows. Each country has its own story, but the contours remain the same. Clean energy, energy efficiency, and the electrification of things that would have once been powered by fossil fuels. While this decoupling is not happening fast enough, the good news is that accelerating it will also create opportunities for new innovations across industries and technologies. Business just needs to seize them. The DC Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. In a typical election year, we would be 7 months away from the first presidential debate of the party's nominees. A date and location are already penciled in, September 16, at Texas State University in San Marcos. The campaign teams of President Joe Biden and his predecessor Donald Trump would likely schedule days of prep away from the trail, and plan to frame the outcome as a win for their side and an abject failure for the other. While that scenario could still happen, a likelier one is that the Texas event gets canceled, as do the ones in Virginia and Utah planned for October. In fact, we may have already seen the final presidential debate of 2024. The one that took place back on January 10 in Des Moines, Iowa, between Republicans Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis. Trump, as he had for every primary debate, skipped it, refusing to share the same air as his lesser polling rivals. Ratings for these events were terrible without Trump. And now we appear to be heading to a game of debate chicken, with the campaign signaling that the likely candidates may never step on the same stage before Election Day. A spokeswoman for Biden's campaign said headquarters would have no comment about the debate schedule. Two spokespeople for Trump's efforts did not even acknowledge the question. At other times, when asked directly about the debates, top officials dodged the issue as being premature, given neither candidate is yet the official nominee, but chat with advisors who claim to be shaping campaign strategy, and their responses reveal themselves to be an attempt to set expectations for a Trump-Biden debate that could still happen, though probably won't. How did we get here? Even before Trump won a single vote or earned a lone delegate in his quest to return to the White House, the Republican National Committee told the long-standing bipartisan group that has organized presidential debates for decades that it was not interested in their planning. If the nominee, presumed even back then in 2022 to be Trump, wanted to face off against the Democratic choice for 2024, they maybe could work out a side deal, but nothing was going to be pushed through the Commission on Presidential Debates. Then, a year later, Trump's contradicted the Central Party's earlier effort on his behalf. "He and I have to definitely debate," Trump said in June, when asked about a head-to-head session against Biden. And Trump half-joked in December that he wanted to make debates a centerpiece of his run. How about 10 debates? A chance to take on Biden might be too tempting for Trump to resist, but he is being counseled to limit his already wide exposure, including in courtrooms. Biden, who harbors a visceral reaction to the former guy, may also be tempted, but he also trusts his inner circle, many of whom are very much against a face-to-face brawl where things could go sideways at any moment. But plainly, debates are one of the easiest ways to reset a campaign's dynamic, and the lure may prove too much. Trump may find the drama too juicy. Biden may want to prove he still has the Trump-slaying skills of 4 years ago. So while the chances of any general election debate happening this fall appear awfully slim, we still cannot rule them out. But there's also the question of how many Americans are persuadable. In a contest of elders, it's possible debates have aged out. Health Matters by Alice Park, Senior Health Correspondent. The latest COVID-19 vaccine offers strong protection against the currently dominant strain of the virus, according to a recent report in the MMWR, published by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. It is the first effectiveness data for the updated vaccine, which was released last fall. Using federal and pharmacy-reported data sets, the team of CDC scientists compared the COVID-19 test results of people who were having symptoms from September 2023 to mid-January 2024 with their vaccination status. They found the new vaccine was about 54% effective. They further calculated the shot was 49% effective at protecting against symptoms from the JN1 variant, which causes most of the new infections occurring in the U.S. right now. That is both good and surprising news, since the shot was designed to target a different version of the virus, the XBB.1.5 variant. This is, to my knowledge, the first vaccine effectiveness estimates available worldwide for JN.1, says Ruth Link Gillis, who leads the vaccine effectiveness program for COVID-19 and RSV at CDC and who led the analysis. What these results show is that someone who got this vaccine would have an extra boost of protection against symptomatic infection from both the XBB variant that was common in the fall as well as JN.1, which is circulating now. Her group plans to release more detailed data on the vaccine's impact on emergency room and urgent care visits, as well as hospitalizations in coming weeks. But Link Gillis says these initial data are encouraging. The COVID-19 vaccine is looking a lot like the flu vaccine, where we see about 50% protection against influenza in a good year, against both infections and hospitalizations. But all COVID-19 immunity wanes whether it is derived from vaccines, infections, or both. Link Gellis says additional data will show how long the protection from vaccination lasts against symptoms of the disease. Previous research suggests protection against severe illness is more durable. The results underscore what doctors and public health officials keep telling us. Vaccines work. Getting vaccinated is even more urgent for people at higher risk of complications from COVID-19, such as the elderly, pregnant people, and those with underlying health conditions. There is elevated COVID-19 activity all across the country, but still very low vaccine coverage, says Dr. Manisha Patel, Chief Medical Officer of CDC's National Center for Infectious Respiratory Diseases. Only 21% of all adults and just 41% of people over 65, the highest risk age group, have gotten the latest shot. These data show that really the time to get vaccinated is now. The View essay, subtitled Society. Rest Actually Takes Hard Work by Alex Soo-Jung Kim Pang. That's P-A-N-G. Pang's a leading advocate for the four-day work week. He's the author of four books, including Rest, Why You Get More Done When You Work Less. Americans have long been known for our industry and ambition, but until recently we also recognized the value of rest. The Puritans had a famously strict work ethic, but they also took their Sundays very seriously. In 1842, Henry David Thoreau observed, "The really efficient laborer will be found not to crowd his day with work, but will saunter to his task, surrounded by a wide halo of ease and leisure." A decade later, he wrote, "A broad margin of leisure is as beautiful in a man's life as in a book." Post-Civil War captains of industry did not rise and grind, according to business journalist Bertie Charles Forbes. No man goes in more wholeheartedly for sport and other forms of recreation than industrialist Coleman DuPont, while Teddy Roosevelt boisterously enters into recreation despite a busy public life. At the same time, union organizers, mass media and entertainment, and the parks movement democratized leisure. Rest became a right, enshrined as much in college sports and penny arcades as in labor law. Richard Nixon, during a campaign speech in 1956, predicted, "New forms of production will evolve to make backbreaking toil and mind-wearying tension a thing of the past, and a four-day week and family life will be enjoyed by every American." Together, these sources paint a vision of American life in which work and leisure are partners in a good life, and machines and electronic devices, as Nixon called them, created more time for everyone. But in recent decades, the world turned against rest. Globalization, the decline of unions, the rise of gig work are factors that have created an environment in which people and companies feel compelled to work constantly. The CEO who steadily worked his way up from the mailroom to the corner office has been replaced by the 20-something genius who makes billions by disrupting the system. Technology lets us carry our offices around in our pockets and makes it almost impossible for us to disconnect from work. Even the blue-tinted glow of our screens and late-night traffic noise can have a measurable impact on the quality of our sleep. And raising children and managing family schedules and Thoreau's wide halo of ease and leisure sounds great, but ultimately impossible. Early in your career, it's easy to believe that passion and youthful energy are inexhaustible, but at some point, family demands, a health scare, or the passage of time forces you to find ways of working that rely on experience rather than raw energy, are more sustainable, and let you run marathons rather than sprints. Not everyone successfully makes the transition. But in studying everyone from Nobel laureates to emergency room nurses, I found people who are able to do the work they love for decades rather than burn out in a few years share a few things in common. There are few things better for us than regular rest, whether it's breaks during the day, hobbies that take our mind off work, weekly Sabbaths or annual vacations, routines that layer periods of work and rest help us be more productive, have more sustainable careers, and enjoy richer and more meaningful lives. But too often, rest gets a bad rap in our always-on, work-obsessed world. It's also the case that learning to rest well is actually hard. Why is that, and how can we rest better? Often, people who have control over their daily schedules layer periods of deep work, as Cal Newport calls it, and deliberate rest time, to both recharge and let the creative subconscious examine problems they have not been able to solve through hard work. Many great scientists, mathematicians, and composers have daily routines in which they work intensively for a couple hours, take a long break, then work a couple more, and those 4 or 5 hours give you enough time to make steady progress on your work and come up with some new, unexpected ideas. People in high stress, unpredictable jobs, cannot depend on such routines, but the most successful at dealing with the challenges of work rely on two other things. First, they have good boundaries between work and personal time. Second, they have serious hobbies, everything from quilting to rebuilding classic cars to running marathons that are as absorbing as their work. This deep play illustrates another important point. The best rest is active, not just passive. We often think of rest as involving a bag of salty snacks and a TV remote, but working out or playing piano actually recharges your mental and physical batteries more effectively than binge-watching that hot new show. Long-term studies reveal another important rest hack. Taking annual vacations boosts your happiness, improves your cardiovascular health, and helps you age better compared with colleagues who chain themselves to the office. You will also be more productive and boost your chances of promotion. Vacations and sabbaticals can also be an incubator for new ideas. Lin-Manuel Miranda started toying with the idea of a musical about Alexander Hamilton after reading Ron Chernow's biography On Vacation. It is no accident that the best idea I've ever had in my life, maybe the best one I'll ever have in my life, came to me on vacation, Miranda said in 2016. The moment my brain got a moment's rest, Hamilton walked into it. So let's say you take rest seriously, recognize it's important for health and performance, and calculate a more disciplined, measured approach to work will pay off in the long run. How can you get started? For many, it begins at work. Reducing distractions, becoming more efficient at tasks you can control, and automating routine duties can create time in your day for short breaks that recharge your batteries and make it easier to maintain clear lines between work and personal time. Better planning and prioritizing will also mean fewer late nights and avoidable crises. Doing this with colleagues amplifies the benefits. Companies that adopt 4-day work weeks succeed because they redesign their workday to give everyone more deep work time, less time in meetings, and fewer interruptions. Next, find your deep play. If you have a hobby you're passionate about, you're more likely to make time for it and feel good about doing it. If you already have a favorite pastime that was crowded out by work, you have permission to take it back up. If not, look for something that offers satisfactions as rich as work when it goes well, but in concentrated doses and in a completely different environment, outdoors and physical if you work in an office. You cannot think about clients on a surfboard. Take your vacations. Shorter, more frequent vacations are often more restorative because they're lower stakes than once-in-a-lifetime expeditions, and a drip feed of anticipation, escape, and recovery is better than one big hit of happiness a year. The only bad vacation is the one you don't take. Finally, play a long game. It may feel like a waste of time at first, but layering periods of work and rest in your day, your week, and your year help you work more consistently, more sustainably, and to a higher level of quality. We are fascinated by youthful genius and overnight success, but immortality level accomplishment often comes later in life, after decades of steady work. Margaret Atwood wrote The Handmaid's Tale when she was 45. Charles Darwin was 50 when he published The Origin of Species. Duke Ellington made his immortal Newport Jazz Festival appearance at 57, and J.R.R. Tolkien published The Return of the King at 63. Deliberate rest, woven into your days and life, acts as a mainspring and regulator, giving you more energy, more ideas, and more time for good work and a good life. In today's always-on world, few things are harder to do than rest, but few things are more worthwhile. This next lengthy article will be abridged. EPA Chief Michael Regan wants to advance environmental justice with the energy industry's help, by Justin Worland. Searching for common ground. Michael Regan loves a good photo op. The EPA administrator spent much of his first 2 years in office crisscrossing the country, attracting a phalanx of local reporters wherever he turned up. But instead of welcoming veterans home or cutting the ribbon on bright and shiny bridges, the sights of Regan's press junkets have included a community plagued by coal ash in Puerto Rico, a Louisiana area in the shadows of petrochemical facilities where residents face high cancer rates, and a West Virginia county with a faulty wastewater treatment plant. On a blistering summer day in 2022, I watched as he brought the cameras to a trailer home in the back roads of Lowndes County, Alabama, where more than 40% of residents have raw sewage on their properties. On rainy days, which are increasing in severity as a result of climate change, the sewage often backs up into people's showers and sinks. Regan sat with the residents in front of a pool of raw sewage, seemingly unperturbed by the smell or the gargantuan bugs flying nearby on that humid morning. "We have a mission," he said. "No one in America in 2022 should have to have a hole in their backyard where waste flows in the very places our children play." Later that day, in an air-conditioned meeting hall, he shared the dais with a member of Congress, a state environmental administrator, and other Biden administration officials to announce a new commitment of federal dollars to tackle the issue. The town hall could not avoid an airing of grievances and allegations that lurked just beneath the surface. Past money had been misspent by government officials. Residents needed to be willing to pay for the costs of better sanitation. It is too hard for local communities to access federal funds, Regan observed quietly before chiming in to make peace. This is a top-to-bottom government partnership, from the White House on down to the mayor's office, he said. I feel the sense of urgency. Everyone at this table does. Making peace in pursuit of progress is the core of Reagan's job. For decades, the EPA has been a lightning rod for industry and conservative states, while environmental advocates have demanded the agency do more faster. The Biden administration's approach to tackling climate change requires buy-in from all of those constituencies. Achieving that consensus is Reagan's challenge. Perhaps nowhere else is that reconciliation harder than in the pursuit of environmental justice. Reagan's task, not just getting conservative states to spend on solutions and businesses to accept new regulations, all while staying engaged with environmental justice leaders, but also to make sure those changes stick. And that article was abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.